Welcome to Sea Views. I'm Julia Gosling and I'm hosting today with Adam Parnell from Chirp. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Julia. How are you doing? All right.
Yes, I'm very well. So we have Matt Shirley and Marco Blanco with us from Safe Harbours in Australia, and they are 11 hours different. It's breakfast time. Hello, guys, and thank you so much for joining us this morning, tonight, whatever it is.
Yes, yeah. Good evening to yourselves, Julia and Adam. Yeah, it's great to be here. And yeah, thanks for inviting us on and for dealing with the time difference.
So you've got a lovely bright day because you can see I've got my woolly jumper on. Adam's got his fleece on. Mm-hmm. So we're into our winter. And what have you got right now?
Well, to be honest, down here in Tasmania, it is currently only about 9 degrees and it's wet and rainy and cold. So you would not expect it to be spring at the moment.
You're making me feel at home. That's great.
Yeah. But you are coming into your summer, aren't you?
We are, yes. Yeah. And I think it's probably a little bit warmer up there in Sydney where Marco
is. It's going to be in the high 30s today here in Sydney.
Nice. Very good.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. Adam and I are really delighted that you can talk to us today and make the time work so that we can have this chat, because something we'd love to talk about is about your work in making maritime safer in Australia. But you've got a lot of expertise, both of you, in bulk carriers. And Adam and I have often sort of said this is a kind of unseen workhorse of the sea, isn't it? And I'd love to find out a bit more from you, Matt and Marco, of what you're up to. And then we could delve into the subject of bulk carriers and what it means, particularly in Australia as well.
Yeah, no, thanks, guys. I think, well, Michael and I both began our careers at sea working for BHP, one of the biggest miners on the planet. And at the time, BHP ran, owned and operated its own fleet of cargo ships, bulk carriers in the main, in order to transport their raw materials and around the country and also overseas. And so, yeah, we kind of began our careers working on bulk carriers and working with bulk carriers. And that's kind of culminated with us ending up piloting vessels in the northwest coast of Australia, where the trade there is all about iron ore, and where we worked, I think about 30% of global seaborne iron ore trade was shipped from that area of Australia. So, yeah, we've got a reasonably strong background in working on, working with operators and working with bulk carriers.
I mean, they are huge volumes, aren't they, these materials? I mean, really, obviously, pretty vital for the global supply chain, but the quantities are just huge, aren't they?
They are, yes. And, well, I think Adam was mentioning earlier that bulk carriers make up maybe 15 or 16% of ship types around the world. In terms of the tons that are shipped, I would imagine that far outweighs anything else in terms of seaborne trade. So, yeah, it's, as you say, the scale of the operation is absolutely massive, and it is something that, to a certain extent, the world turns on, I think.
And it's growing. The size of global fleet is bulk carriers is growing massively, which is really impressive.
And Australia just seems to be, given all the mineral resources that you have there, you've got some of the biggest quantities being exported, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. I used to joke that we were essentially creating the inland sea that they never found when they discovered Australia. That's obviously not the case, but yeah, certainly the resources that we have, all the kind of the western side of Australia is red, it's iron ore, and the east coast has got a lot of coal, which is exported as well. So yeah, and across the north coast, we have a lot of bauxite as well that's exported. So yeah, in terms of minerals that we have to provide the rest of the world, we've got a lot there.
To your point there, Matt, you guys are like a real Australia in that part of the world, very much an epicenter of the bulk of bulk carrier business, that sector really does converge on Australia in a way that the super yacht sector might converge on sort of Gibraltar or Florida or other places. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, fascinating to get you both of your insights into this. But do you want to tell us a little bit about safe harbours in Australia to start with? That's sort of at the top, and just put that into some context.
Yeah, sure. Look, Safe Harbours Australia came about. There are three of us involved in the business. And what we noticed over our careers working together, both at sea and as pilots, was that there was a lot of opportunity there, I guess, to improve training. And we've had a huge interest in wanting to continue that training and our understanding of what it means to operate on the bridge in a safe way, in a safe manner. And we've taken that to the next level, I guess, in terms of wanting to take that to the rest of the world, take that to crews, bulk carrier crews specifically, because that's where we come from. That's our big knowledge. And as we were kind of winding down towards the end of our pilotage career, we realised that we had an opportunity to start trialling some of these ideas we had in terms of bringing safety ideas from other industries into the maritime industry, because people often compare the two, but they are different. And the tools that you would use in order to make a bridge or the wheelhouse safer are going to be different from the tools that you use to make a cockpit safer, but the same principles apply. And that's one of the things that we would like to do with Safe Harbours Australia.
Brilliant. I can see how both your long-standing experience as maritime pilots is perfect for that, because you don't just get experience of a few ships, you get experience of that bridge set up on so many different vessels, don't you? So it's a perfect experience, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. What we found over the years was that within minutes of walking onto the bridge of a ship, you need to be able to build a rapport, build a relationship with the bridge team that you're working with, and create a team that will work together, a team that has never met each other before. But so we need to be able to walk on board and instill a certain amount of trust from the team in us. And we need to also learn what we can trust about the team that we're working with as well, a team that we've never met. And the first 30 seconds really do count when you meet people, and the way you introduce yourself to them and the way you then conduct yourself throughout the rest of the passage makes a huge difference. So we don't just walk on board the ship and talk to the captain. We talk to the whole bridge team. And that's such an important element of one of the messages that we want to get across. I've been doing quite a bit of reading into safety and complexity. And we really do operate in a very complex environment in the maritime industry. And understanding that communication is the key to overcoming that complexity is another big learning that we would like to try and bring to other pilots, other bridge teams, other organisations, because that same complexity exists whether you're talking about a ship or whether you're talking about an organisation that runs 100 ships. Those lines of communication and understanding that there are different perspectives that people take towards safety and risk is paramount. But if you're not talking about it, you're not going to understand that other people have different perspectives, and you're not going to be able to overcome those different perspectives and those different ideas.
That's music to my ears, everything you've just said, as somebody that runs a maritime safety charity. And I couldn't agree with you more. You're bang on with the communication, and being able to build that instant rapport is, I think, that's a real skill set that pilots generally tend to develop anyway. But to your point about being able to walk on board a ship and almost smell the culture, almost sort of just get that vibe, I've often said pilots really are the eyes and ears of a port if they're used correctly. And I'm sure you, with that sort of experience that both of you have, you're able to very quickly pick up on a sort of sense of whether things are running well, not running well. And where I'd like to understand perhaps a little bit more, if you could unpack it, is once you've got that sense of where things are or aren't running smoothly, sort of, how do you make use of that information?
That's a very good question. And I guess it goes back to the heart of what we were just talking about. I don't know if Marco has anything else that he wants to add in here. It's about understanding what the team then needs to work together and to operate together. So one of the big things that we like to talk about is involving the whole bridge team. So we often talk about a master pilot exchange as being the key to a successful bridge resource management process, we tend to think of it in terms of a bridge team exchange. So we're not just talking to the master. When I walked onto a ship, I would ask for all the officers to come to the bridge. And that way I could actually speak to, if the chief mate was up forward, I could speak to him. And he then understood, and he watched the whole master pilot exchange or bridge team exchange, if you like. So he then understood the big picture. And he knew that when I was talking to him, I really needed him to be a part of that team, and that if he thought that something was wrong, then I needed to know that. And the second mate down aft would be exactly the same. The third mate on the bridge, the officer of the watch, incredibly important. And on top of that, you've got the person that I probably give the most orders to after having, I might speak to the master a little bit more, but the person I give the most orders to on board a ship is the helmsman. He is key to the whole operation. And he is the one that's going to see if there's a problem with the steering. And we might have more engine failures in general, but steering failures are the ones that happen like that.
Yeah.
And you have seconds to react to them sometimes. And if he hesitates in telling someone and he happens to tell the wrong person and they hesitate and they try and solve it themselves and they don't tell the pilot, then those seconds can rapidly turn into a disaster. Whereas if everyone, if the helmsman knows what he's doing and the helmsman, he feels a part of the team and he knows that he can speak straight to the pilot and say, I've got a problem, everyone can react together and everyone can react and hopefully save the day.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that 30 seconds, you're a cable off track potentially, straight off, 30 seconds. But just to go back to the fact we're talking about here about bulk carriers and the size of that fleet, what's been really pleasing, I was reading a few months ago from Intercargo, they did an annual report, their annual report that comes out and came back out back in the summer. And they're seeing a sort of year-on-year decline in terms of the worst casualties of ships being lost, which is great to see. And perhaps without putting you on the spot, either of you, just wondering if you've got any sense of why it is or how it is that the bulk carrier sector is able to sort of deliver that improving safety year on year, which is not actually always, or I certainly know there are other sectors without sort of naming and shaming where that isn't the case. And I think, as you said earlier about people being able to learn from one another, I'd love to hear your sort of insights into what you think is aiding that sort of improvement.
And if you agree with it.
Yeah, that too.
I read the same report. I might throw to Marco here because he's, some of his background during our training as junior officers brought him into touch with some of the people that worked in the BHP office. So he's actually got a bit more background in that, and he might have a few more insights that he can draw on for that.
Yeah. So back when I was a cadet in the early 90s, in Australia, we had a lot of bulk carrier losses, particularly in 1990, 91. In a period from 89 to 91, there were 50 bulk carrier losses around the world.
Wow.
Including 9 from Australia, so 20% were from Australia. 6 of them, iron ore carriers, lost, sunk from Western Australian load ports. So there was an investigation by the Australian government called the Ships of Shame Report. And one of the key deliverables from that was the enhanced port state control inspections and regional cooperation on port state control inspections. So our Maritime Safety Authority, AMSA, became one of the leaders in port state control, and they're still known around the world for being probably the harshest inspectors of ships. And as a consequence of those enhanced port state control inspections, the nature of the bulk carrier fleet changed quite quickly. Because of the recession in the late 80s, a lot of ships were plying the seas that should have been scrapped, but the scrap prices were so low, they continued plying the oceans. And unfortunately, a lot of them, well, too many, were lost. So port state control inspections and those Ships of Shame reports have continued in Australia right up to the present day. And that has definitely improved the quality of bulk carriers over that period.
Added to that, that's good news.
We have been, that's fantastic news. And then we've had these independent inspections like RightShip that have been doing inspections for the charterers and the ship owners. And that has also improved the safety of bulk carriers as well.
that's a really good background, actually, bit of overview, because they have got, they do seem to have a bit more of a reputation. Maybe we can unpick that in a bit. But first of all, the types of reasons that they're being lost. Could you talk us through some of those main risks? Matt or Marco, so, whoever wants to take it. Matt, your connection's slightly better, I have to say. On the internet.
Okay. Yeah, look, one of the, well, there were a number of issues that they came across and it came out of the investigation with the Ships of Shame report. One was that they were starting to build ships with smaller scantlings, so they weren't being built as strongly. And as those smaller scantlings were subjected to greater and greater forces over longer and longer periods of time because people wanted to run the ships for longer, low margin trade, the smaller scrap prices or low scrap prices, the ships became older, essentially, and they became overstressed. There was also this, there was a bit of a fad there for a little while to try and, they thought that it was a good idea to spread the stress of load across these incredibly heavy cargoes, iron ore is incredibly dense, with alternate hatch loadings. Why anyone thought that was a good idea at the time, I've got no idea. But yeah, that led to increased stresses, and all of a sudden ships would break apart in the middle of the sea and they would go down very quickly. I'm sure a lot of people have probably seen that video of the Stella Banner, the Vale Max bulk carrier that ran aground just out of Brazil and was declared essentially a total constructive loss, full of iron ore. They scuttled her and she went down incredibly quickly. You can imagine that happening in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, halfway between Australia and China, and a ship that had been overstressed, overloaded, was too old, hadn't been inspected properly. It would just go down so quickly and the crew would not even know that it was happening at the time.
Yeah, that's tragic.
The thought of that is, yeah, absolutely harrowing. That's a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that we see when we work with the intermanager is cargo liquefaction. I know it used to be an issue in bulk carriers.
It certainly has been an issue, and I think you mentioned that Intercargo report earlier. I think liquefaction issues are on the decline again. I think there are more processes involved in terms of testing the cargo and making sure that TML limits, transportable moisture limits, are within spec. And I think, again, that's been a bit of a communication and a training issue that has been for the better that's helped resolve that issue.
Yeah.
Liquefaction of the cargo is something that used to happen quite a bit, certainly when you're loading fine cargoes, fine iron ores. Iron ore, again, incredibly dense cargo. When it's fine and the moisture drops out of it and the cargo starts to operate or as a free surface or as a liquid, all of a sudden you lose the ship's inherent stability and, yeah, the ship will actually capsize because of that.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah, that because it's acting like a liquid, so it affects, yes, the freeboard?
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's like having a, yeah, you imagine a 50-metre long Olympic-sized swimming pool where the pool's not stuck in the ground, but it's actually swimming over. But, that whole body of water sloshing from side to side creates its own turning moments, and when that combines in the right way, it will effectively turn a ship over.
Yeah, yeah. But when you talked earlier, well, you just mentioned TML, the transportable moisture limits, and that's very good regulation in terms of paperwork. But what I think where Australia really is leading the charge is, I think it was Marco mentioned earlier about port state control inspections. And Australia, I think rightly and probably proudly, as you said, is known to be quite a sort of hard marker of people's homework to make sure that they're safe. And I actually think that we've often said, we often hear people tell us that regulations are missing or we need more regulations. And it's only a personal theory that we don't lack regulations. We lack the enforcement of those regulations. And what I really like about Australia and AMSA is they are known to be quite hard over on actually making sure people meet those regulations, no shortcuts. And as a result, I think that's why even we talk about the epicenter of bulk fleet in Australia, it's why it's one of those safer sea areas of the world, despite all that sort of density of shipping.
Yeah, I think you are correct. And that comes from everything that Marco was just talking about, that whole period where there were so many ships lost. We learned that we can't afford to do that. We are an island nation that depends on trade to maintain our way of life and our GDP. So we can't afford to have ships that don't make it in and out of the country. There's also very much a moral obligation there to make sure that ships do arrive safely and they can depart safely.
Yeah.
And if that means enforcing regulations, then that's one way of doing that. That does bring me to another thought that I do have on the whole idea of regulation and enforcement of regulations. Yes, it does make people's lives more difficult when they have to deal with an AMSAR port state control inspection. But I think this comes back to a bit of a cultural issue. If people understand that the port state control inspectors are there to make sure that the vessel is safe and that they're only trying to do the right thing, then if they do have a problem, don't hide it. Talk to the port state control inspector and say, look, I'm sorry, we do actually have this problem here. And the port state control inspector is probably going to talk to them about ways in which they can resolve the issue, as opposed to finding something that was hidden under a bit of canvas. For want of a bit of painted canvas, for want of a better way of describing something that might be hidden. And I think changing that cultural mindset to one of openness and, again, communication, talk to people. Port state control inspectors don't want to see someone hurt. They want to try and do the right thing. They want to try and improve the process. They want to make people's lives safer. So work with them in order to help improve the situation or the industry.
Yeah, I mean, that is something, and I'm not going to name names, but that is something that I wish some other regulatory bodies around the world took that attitude as well. I know companies do tend, or sometimes they look at the risk of being detained and therefore the sort of impact on a ship's operational schedule, and they very much see that as in a commercial, through a commercial lens, and quite rightly, because they're there to make money. But you're right to remind us and the audience that actually it's really, it's about looking through this through the safety lens and about keeping people in the ship safe. So, let's hope that is something that others take on board as well. Okay, so what else, if there was sort of, what else are you seeing that's making this changing in Australia or in AMSA or in the way you're seeing vessels operating? Are you seeing any trends in terms of safety? Are you seeing anything particularly good, anything particularly bad?
I think there has been a very slow change towards more consistency, and that's part and parcel of the port state control inspections and people realizing, I think there is a bit of a mindset shift there. People are starting to realize that you're not just needing to tick a box in order to get the next job. It's a good idea to make sure you understand why that box needs to be ticked in order to improve not just safety but the overall efficiency of the running of a vessel. I've always been of the opinion that if safety isn't the be-all and end-all, if you can create a culture in which everyone wants to be safe, you're not only creating a safe culture, you're creating an efficient culture. And that is going to help improve the longevity of your asset, the ship, and also the crews that are running that ship. So,
yeah, it sounds like you're saying you've seen an upwards trend then in what you'd call professionalism then, which is a positive.
I think so. I think there is certainly a bit of a change in mindset. There are probably more operators out there who are starting to think that, we actually do need to look after our assets and look after our people, because the people are the ones that look after our asset. We're starting to realise how big the shipping industry is. So I wouldn't necessarily want to speak for the rest of the industry, but, I would hope that is starting to occur. I mean, Adam, you'd have more information and data on that, and whether or not you think there's improvements in that way?
There's definitely an improvement. I think year on year we're seeing improvement on lots of things. But the point you made right at the outset of that was about the slow pace of that change. I get it. I get why commercial pressures, but it does need to change. And the reason it needs to change, I think, is because of all the sort of decarbonisation and the automation that's coming into shipping. There's some big changes coming out. And I guess we're seeing that in the bulk sector too. So in terms of like AI to help with routing and help with loading and sort of calculations and all these sorts of things. I mean, do you see an impact in terms of either technology change or in terms of the decarbonisation agenda that's happening?
Yeah, technology is evolving so quickly at the moment. It's hard to keep pace with it. The technology is being created. It's being thrown on board ships without people necessarily understanding the potential implication of that. I do remember coming across a situation where there was a bit of AI technology that was plonked on board the bridge, and I thought that was fascinating. So I wanted to speak to the master and the officers about how they worked it, and they said, well, don't know. They just plonked it on board the ship and they're data gathering, and that's all we know. That was a bit of artificial intelligence that was meant to ultimately help make things safer. And I'm sure it will one day, but is that necessarily the way to introduce a new piece of technology? And then training the crew in order to use it is probably going to give them more information than just plonking it on board and conducting a bit of an experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah, experimenting on seafarers, what's new? So there's quite a lot of change in maritime now, isn't there? Maritime security, that's obviously a big concern for most shipping companies now, depending on where they're operating. Any particular thoughts on that?
Again, that's delving back into the technology side of things these days. We're seeing the news reports all the time about spoofing of GNSS, global navigation satellite systems, and the potential issues involving people losing track of where they are. So, yeah, it is becoming a big issue. And I know you just did an episode on the dark fleet or the shadow fleet.
Yes.
I think security issues have always been there. It's just the nature of those security issues is changing. I was a third mate on an LNG tanker departing Singapore years and years ago, and 11:45, just as I was about to hand over the watch, the traffic was just dying down. I was tired at the end of a busy watch, and all of a sudden, I happened to look at the radar and there was a trail of a very fast boat coming up behind us. Thankfully, we still had a double lookout at that stage. So I looked down the back and there was a speedboat at midnight coming up on our quarter. And this is an LNG tank, a Moss Rosenberg LNG tank, the classic thing with the four balls on the deck. Why on earth would a pirate be trying to attack that particular ship? No idea. Until about a year or so later, there was a book released called The Petro Ranger, I think it was, where an Australian master had written this book. He'd been on a little loop oil tanker, of which there are hundreds floating around the place. His ship had actually been hijacked on that same night, and they had tried to steal the cargo, change the paperwork, take it overseas and on-sell it. Loop oil was probably worth about $20 million back in those days. This was quite some time ago. And he postulated the theory that the attack on our ship, because we called a Mayday in, was a diversion to throw the light off what was actually happening. So it was one big organised orchestrated attack.
Wow.
So security issues have always existed, but I think the nature of those issues is changing these days and is changing faster and faster with AI. And as quickly as we can catch up using other forms of technology, people are developing more and more things.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes down to the political tensions that are going on, you know, what the Houthis say about why they're attacking ships in the Red Sea. It doesn't make the seafarer's life any easier, and I don't know what the solution is. But, it's certainly an increasing issue in certain areas. And,
And I guess it has to be incorporated in training as well if things are being updated, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
It's being somewhat prepared for what might come your way as a team. I don't want to ever end on any negatives. I'm quite an optimist, really. Even in the darkest hours, aren't I, Adam? And when we get towards the end of an episode, I do ask guests if there was one change you'd like to see happen to make maritime safer. Could be on a local scale, could be on a global scale, but what would you change, or what would you like to see change, Matt and Marco?
Marco?
Yeah, more leadership and management training for the officers on the ships. Our own experience is that we went through our career from cadet to pilot and received very little actual leadership training. It was kind of one of those things you just learnt by osmosis. And that would change the welfare of seafarers significantly if the leadership on board the ship and ashore were to receive that kind of training for to become better leaders, essentially, they'd be more effective and they would be safer, and the individual welfare of all of the seafarers would improve.
I think that's a brilliant one, don't you, Adam? We've done toxic leadership and what it is to be a good leader at sea, and we've really explored that topic before, how important it is for not just productivity, but as you said, happy, safe crews as well.
And what about you, Matt?
If I could change one thing, it would be the way, and I did touch on it earlier, it would be the way we think about ship's crews. So it would be a mindset change or a cultural change. And look, that's a complete overgeneralization. There are a lot of good operators out there who do consider their crews to be assets. But, yeah, I think if we were to move away from thinking of crews as just a necessity and a commodity and started treating them as the asset that they are in order to help maintain and operate, we need the ship's crews. So let's treat them with the professionalism, the respect that they deserve. One of the ironic things I think about the communication and the technology that we were talking about earlier is that we have this huge amount of oversight of what's actually happening on board ships.
Yep.
But because of that, some of the autonomy that Marco and I experienced in our earlier days, because you didn't have that same communication, has been lost. And that's brought about a bit of a loss of trust on both sides. If we could reinstill that trust and reinstill that respect and give a little bit more, a bit more trust back to the crews and let them, the ones at the coalface, advise the people back on shore what it is that they're actually facing and what they're having to deal with, and let them make a few more decisions, then we might find that things start operating a little more smoothly. When people feel trusted, they choose to be involved. Mm. And involved people are safer and they're more efficient. And Marco and I have actually seen that take place. There was a change in the way a certain element of the port was operated. People went from being employees to being partners in the way tug fleets were operated. And the change was incredible. People had ownership of what it was that they were trying to achieve, and it made things better. I know it's a big ask to change the shipping industry as a whole like that. Small steps, baby steps. Maybe if we start, and that feeds back into the training of people as well, as Marco was alluding to before. Yeah, if we can start treating people as the assets that they are as opposed to the commodity or the necessity, then I think we might see a change for the better.
Really good, really good. Well, given that I didn't give you any warning of those questions, that's quite impressive, guys.
Both. Yeah, definitely. Well, that's a good point to end on, I think.
We end on a positive, and it's been really interesting getting a little bit of a window into summer on the other side of the world and maritime matters in Australia from a couple of real experts. Really enjoyed that. We're going to have to ring the bell now and leave the bridge, but we won't be suffering from any liquefaction. We're going to go very safely off the bridge now. And thank you so much guys for joining us. Thank you. Fishing vessel Grateful and Lovely Coast Guard, we are reading you out at sea.